All right, tonight we're looking at creation in general and creation of the invisible spirit world. The unseen spirit world. You've read these pages, so I don't have to read them. In fact, one of my students in public speaking the other day gave a strong speech on one thing he dislikes very violently, and that's professors reading the class notes. So I took some exhortation from that, and you've read this material, so all I'd like to do is highlight certain things, point out certain things, perhaps expand some things, and then most of the time we could spend on discussion of relevant questions. You notice I included on page 15, after having given some quotations, the whole of Genesis 1:1 to 2:4. There was a method in that madness. Realize you all have Bibles, so, I mean, you could easily do that yourself. But we're going to be looking back and forth at that text, so I wanted to include it here at this place. Again, you've read these other scriptures, pages 16, 17, top of page 18. So it's not necessary to read those either. Development of the doctrine. First of all, creation is a free act of God. Not a necessary act, not an act arising out of a need within the Godhead that had to be satisfied, but it is an act arising out of God's sovereign good pleasure. A free act. Questions on that? It's good, by the way, as you read, to jot down questions. And as we come to class, then you can raise the questions. So easy to forget questions, you know? Young.
I was just wondering, you were saying under the creation of the history of the fact that when you look at Apple, what are you saying? Are you saying that one thing is that God has to do is what is
what is inside? It's not my intention here to develop the doctrine of the Trinity as far as interpersonal relationships, but that sentence, in the conditional sense, necessity is true in the opera ad extra, but in the absolute sense, it's only true in the opera ad intra. There, the relationships that we're talking about is the eternal relationships between the persons of the Godhead, especially recognizing and realizing that each person has all of the divine attributes, so that when we talk about God being a spirit, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth, all those apply in their relationships to one another from eternity. That does not mean that when we talk about love between the members of the Trinity, that that love does not flow as an action toward one another. By necessity, I don't mean, and the theologians don't mean, that love is a necessity in the sense that the flow of love is a necessity. but the relationship between the persons in terms of love and how it's defined, that is a necessity. They love one another and perfectly, so that you can say infinitely and unchangeably and eternally they love one another. It doesn't mean there are no actions, that they're just static, that they're not dynamic in their interrelationships. So in a sense, they love one another, and that's a settled thing. And in another sense, there are expressions of that love toward one another, in that they're dynamic. So even two people who say they love one another can still express that love toward one another, even though there's a settled relationship of love between them. And here we're talking about the settled relationship, not about actions between them. Yeah. That is a little confusing, and it could be inferred from that that God is purely static. He's pure being, or pure act, as Aquinas suggested, so that there's no movement within the Godhead, and therefore nothing dynamic. That would make a very sterile kind of concept of the Trinity, and does not appear to reflect the relationship between the persons at all. Yeah. Secondly, creation is a temporal act of God. Any question on that? Creation is a temporal act of God. That is, it's not an eternal creating, an eternal action going on and on and on from eternity, so that there's no beginning to the initial creation, no ending to the original creation. In which case, any statement of God acting would somehow become suspect. If everything is an eternal act, then there wouldn't be any before and after. There wouldn't be any sequence. Everything would be eternal. And of course, the idea of an act of God that brings the time dimension of the physical universe into existence, that is indeed what is intended by temporal act, a temporal act of God. It brings time into existence. Bart.
Yeah, in one time, I believe you were going to give a talk at Emory on the relation of God and time.
Yeah, I'm still working on it.
I never got a chance to hear.
I'm still working on it. They're still trying to pressure me to do that.
I think you did an excellent presentation.
Thank you.
But anyway, in point two here, you make the comments made here that by temporal act is meant that it's an act of God that occurred at a point in the sequence of God's own ongoing self-experience. So I'm trying to understand that in relationship to God. When you have a sequence of events, whether you have a physical set of time or not, is that sort of indicating that at least experientially, God has a sequence of events that are before and after? Okay.
That's what is intended by that. Exactly. So that, for example, there's a before the initial act of creation in God's self-experience, then there's a putting forth of creative energy, and then there is something there which is created. So there's a before and after in his self-experience in terms of God putting forth efficiency to create. Before that putting forth that efficiency, there was God and nothing. After that putting forth, there's God and the universe. Or at least the initial aspects of the universe. Same thing is true with the incarnation. There's a real before and after in the incarnation. The second person of the Trinity, before he became incarnate, was God and only God. Then he becomes incarnate, and there's a real becoming in John 1:14. The Word became flesh. So that he became the God-man, which he never was before. And that's in his own self-experience. He takes into union with himself a true human nature. So I stump rather strongly for the idea, not of duration, but of sequence in the concept of time in God's own self-experience. Yeah. I'm not talking again about physics time, because that's measured duration, and that has to do with some rather complicated concepts that have nothing to do with ultimate sense of time. Thirdly, the triune God is the author of creation. By the way, I think we could say that about the triune God being involved in providence and in redemption and in judgment as well. That's kind of interesting to study that out. It would be nice to see that developed in a thesis or a dissertation or a book. The role that each of the three persons of the Trinity plays in each of those areas. Very fascinating. Fourthly, creation gives to all created beings a distinct yet dependent existence. Now, you've got to somehow hold that in balance. It's a distinct existence. In other words, created beings, created things, are not God. They're distinct from God. And yet they're dependent upon God. In one sense, therefore, they're independent as far as being distinct from Him. They're not God. In another sense, they're totally dependent upon God for their existence. And that concept, admittedly, is a little difficult for some people to grasp. The idea of bringing into existence that which is not the Creator. Fifthly, the concept of creation may be studied under distinct conceptions which differ according to the use of primary or secondary efficiency in the employment of or non-employment of pre-existing materials. Now, I'd like you to get the distinction between these three definitions very clearly. This is important. Creation ex nihilo, immediate creation, mediate creation. And I'd like to give an illustration of each. But first, I want to get clear on the definition. Creation ex nihilo, bringing into being of that which is not God, that's true in all three, using neither previously existing materials nor secondary causes. Now, what's an illustration of a secondary cause? Well, one illustration of that would be parents who have children. There are secondary causes. They bring into the world children. They bring children into existence. That's a remarkable power, the power of creation. Of course, Tolkien would call it subcreation, and that's quite appropriate because it's under God. It's always under God, and it's always using causal powers that are given to the sub-creators by God Himself. Immediate creation, someone will say, hey, creation ex nihilo is immediate, isn't it? Well, see, here's just a distinction of terms, and you'll have to bear with me. I'm using the terms technically. Creation ex nihilo, immediate creation, God uses previously existing materials. But He doesn't use secondary causes. See, in the first one, it's creation from nothing. God is the creator, not using previously existing materials, not using any secondary causes. Here, He uses previously existing materials, but not secondary causes. Now, in immediate creation, He uses both. Previously existing materials, secondary causes. Illustration. Creation ex nihilo. The creation of the original energy of the universe. That in itself is mind-boggling when you think of the total amount of creation which is in the observable universe. Secondly, immediate creation. God takes dust from the ground, takes dirt from the ground, and out of it He forms the body of man. And then He takes matter, physical flesh, from the body of man and forms the body of woman. He uses previously existing materials, but He does the creating directly. So he doesn't use any secondary causes, but he does use previously existing material. The third one, I've already given an illustration. God does the creating of every child. God is the creator of every child, but he does it through the parents. And then I've added some other ideas there. Works of genuine sub-creativity that reflect his goodness, truth, and beauty. Human beings have been given wonderful powers. Wonderful powers. They can produce marvelous structures of thought. They can produce wonderful objects of art and music. Wonderful things. And of course, even the unregenerate can produce some very remarkable things in terms of truth and beauty. Now, we've got to try to account for that. How do you account for that? That's a good question. How do you account for a relative goodness which is found in some human beings? How do you account for truth wherever we find it, even if discovered by someone who rejects totally the concept of God and God being the source and touchstone of all truth? How do we account for the beautiful works of music and sculpture and art that we find, literature and so forth? Wonderful things. How do we account for that? That is, if these people cut themselves off consciously or unconsciously from the source of goodness and truth and beauty, then whence do they have these things? How do they come to them? How do they actually do these things? Now, maybe you think that nobody does these things, but I would dispute that. I think there are some very, very marvelous things that the unregenerate have been enabled to do. And the question is, what's the explanation for that? Well, we'll look at that further down the road.
Your distinctions here between these three terms, technical terms for creation, seem a little different than most amorous definitions.
Okay. Tell us the difference.
Well, they seem to imply that immediate creation, like they state, immediate creation is creation out of nothing.
Yes.
Okay, and I'm just trying to draw that out because they may use that later on in the work.
That's right.
That understanding, as opposed to from pre-existing material, they define immediate creation.
Yes. So what I've done merely is not fight with them, but made a further distinction. And I've really, on the one hand part, I've distinguished between not using previously existing materials and using previously existing materials, but God creating directly in both cases. And the other, using previously existing materials and using existing materials and secondary causes, that can be put together under their head of what, mediate creation? And I've merely made a distinction between those two so as to get a genuine sense of sub-creativity in there. Okay, I think that's needed. So I don't really disagree with them in that. I've merely made a further distinction. And of course, in another sense, someone could say it's bad language, because in one and two, they're both immediate, you know? Okay, so problem is to find another word. It's not that we don't have a lot of words in Roget's thesaurus. It's just that it's difficult to find just the precise word that you need to describe the distinction. Questions on this thus far? All right, theories that oppose the doctrine of creation. I've listed here dualism, emanationism, creation from eternity, and naturalistic evolutionism. Naturalistic evolutionism sounds like an awful big mouthful. Why don't you just say natural evolution or something, or just evolution, period? You know, shorthand. Well, you notice that in naturalistic evolutionism, naturalistic is a modifier, and it intends merely not to add something to evolutionism, but merely to analyze it. So it's an analytical rather than a synthetic term. It doesn't add anything. It just analyzes evolutionism. It analyzes it and says it's naturalistic. That's all it does. So it's an analytical term which modifies evolutionism. But you notice instead of evolution, I've said evolutionism. Now, what does that do? Well, it takes evolution as a biological theory and extends it to the whole universe. That is, not the biological confining it to that, but extends the idea of evolution to non-living things as well, to the whole development of the universe. So I've mentioned the structured universe, life, man, even culture, human culture. Evolutionism is really the doctrine of evolution expanded to a worldview. That's really what it's all about. Questions on any of these four? Dualism, emanationism, creation from eternity, naturalist, the evolutionism. By the way, not wanting to give a commercial, but in the spring quarter, there will be a course on creationism and evolutionism, in case anybody's interested in that, in which we'll discuss a lot of these matters in an expanded fashion and have a lot of interesting discussion, and also hopefully a field trip to the American Museum of Natural History in New York. I'd like to take one to the Smithsonian, but alas, it's too far. And you can't make a day trip if you have to have a 3.5-hour journey one way. That's 7 hours already. You can't really make a day out of it. Now, to New York, we can get there in 2 hours. So that's more reasonable. And they have wonderful displays of fossils in New York, especially of dinosaurs. Very wonderful. Well, enough of the commercial. Dualism is very attractive to a lot of people. Matter is eternal. God is eternal. Dualism. Dualism has been around a long time. Sometimes it's called Persian dualism, Manichaeism. Good and evil are eternal forces and constantly in conflict. Here, it has to do mainly with God and matter. God is one of the two in dualism. Matter or matter energy is the other of the two. And someone will say, I don't see any problem with it. What's the problem? And I've suggested here that if one says, can't you view matter as being eternally dependent upon God? Thus, you can have your dualism and still have matter dependent upon God. What a neat solution. I simply raise the question, in what sense is matter dependent upon God? In what sense? Is it dependent on God for its existence? Obviously not, if matter is eternal. So then, what does dependent mean? That's all I'm asking. If someone says, matter's eternal, but it's not ultimate in the sense that it's independent of God, it's dependent upon God. Okay, dependent in what sense? That's always a question I want to raise. And if it's not if it is dependent for its existence, then what does dependent mean, okay, if you deny that? I suggest matter is dependent upon God for its existence. If he holds it in existence, then what in the world can one mean by eternal matter? Emanationism is a view associated with Plotinus and the Neoplatonists, going all the way back to the 2nd century of the Christian era. It's a very interesting view. Tends to lend itself to some of the Eastern religions. Creation from eternity, we've already discussed. Naturalistic evolutionism is a view which has virtually swept the scientific community. Not simply as a biological theory, but as a worldview, a philosophy. And it appears in most of our universities and colleges. It underlies a great deal of the thinking in various disciplines and fields. As some people don't run up against it directly, but it sort of insidiously makes its way into various realms of thought, various disciplines, and underlies a lot of things that are taught and said. It's naturalistic in that it denies God. It doesn't need God. It doesn't need that hypothesis, as one philosopher put it. And we see it every day. You see it in magazines, you see it in articles in various journals, you see it in books, you see it in television, wherever you go. This somehow creeps in as far as the worldview and mindset. It's not always explicit. Sometimes it's very subtle, but it's there. Questions? Who was first? Jeff?
As I was reading Lewis and Everest,
yes,
that they were saying quite clearly that there's really very little evidence for the macro evolution that would be required for this theory to be true. Admittedly, there is evidence of micro evolution within certain species, and yet even some of the great evolutionists would agree that the time required for such massive evolution does not exist. And so it was interesting to me that so many, quote, intelligent people and geniuses in their field would take on such a view with, if, as they say, such little evidence for this massive evolution that would be required.
Did you notice their reference, a brief reference to punctuated equilibrium? Okay. Well, punctuated equilibrium takes the view that things can speed up very quickly and things can develop very quickly in terms of change, geologically very quickly, not what we would consider very quickly. But Niles Eldridge and Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard have really pushed punctuated equilibrium, and it threatens to become the majority view, although it's not the majority view yet. They're trying to push it hard, where instead of having a the line, genera, families, orders, and so on, you have very rapid change and then a period of stasis or quiescence with very little change, and then a period of rapid change again. And the suggestion is that's the explanation of the relative lack of fossil evidence to support evolution is in its broad sense. It's a rather neat theory in that it explains a lot. But once again, and perhaps even worse than the previous synthesis, it's very low on facts to support its theory. And that's a very real problem. But, and here's the big but they say, what other explanation is there? You see, and that carries a lot of weight. What other explanation is there? And so they suggest that a creationist interpretation is purely a religious interpretation, and because religious interpretations arise not out of rational thought, but arise out of the emotions, or arise out of a religious frame of desire, or arise out of who knows what. Therefore, the religious explanation, that is, creationism, is not to be viewed with any sense of of weight. Yes.
Don't they also cite that the fossil evidence seems to indicate that a high majority of the species all existed together, okay, at the same period of time, that there isn't that we had some amphibian existing back here some millions of years ago, and then all of a sudden a reptile shows up a couple thousand years or a million years later, that the large majority of creatures existed and have fossil evidence at the same time. And so how do we then justify that from one origin we all, you know, come?
Well, even the very strong proponents from the Creation Research Society admit that in the various geologic strata, you do have a series of fossils or various kinds of invertebrates and then fish and amphibians and reptiles and birds and mammals, and that you do show these coming into the fossil record and then certain ones becoming extinct and then branching out and so forth, branching out. But you do have that kind of a sequence in the fossil record. The question is how to interpret the fossil record. That is, they suggest you do have this kind of order, and you could interpret it evolutionistically, or you could interpret it in some other fashion. But they all suggest that in general, that's what you have. So that's not in question, okay? Yes, Clark.
I was in a comment in a similar fashion. I've been pretty interested in this for a while.
Good.
I'm a scientist, so.
Splendid.
One thing I wanted to comment on the text is I was the only thing I found so far that I was a little disappointed in.
Yes.
In Lewis and Demarest is that the papers and the works that they cite are quite old scientifically. They cite the study by Kirkcut from 1960.
Yes.
And it's essentially irrelevant at this point, increased understanding of science.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the claims that he makes about lack of interrelationship would not hold today with modern scientific knowledge.
Yeah.
I just was, you know, I realize they're not scientists approaching this, but they do leave that. When reading it, one should be aware of that. But a lot of the information, though I think essentially correct, is somewhat dated.
Very good.
And one thing in relation to your question, that's an excellent diagram, because if one looks at traits of organisms, the way they classified them before, you end up with a phylogenetic tree like that. What's more interesting is recently with all the genetic studies that have been done, there is a tremendous interrelationship in terms of DNA homology among all the species.
Yes.
And if you want to sort that data, you end up with a diagram very similar to the diagrams that have been drawn in the past to sort of support that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the real question is does that make a stronger case for evolution or not?
Yes.
In my opinion, not.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of good reasons, mm-hmm. One can analyze that data and see a lot of different interpretations of it.
Yes.
But one of the important things, I think, for creationists today is to be able to deal with the current data as it is, as opposed to data from 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah. You know, it's very difficult for people not in a particular discipline to keep up. In fact, it's hard to keep up in your own discipline, let alone keep up in other disciplines.
I absolutely agree.
With the great increase of specialization, it's so difficult to be a generalist and keep abreast of developments in general as they're happening in various disciplines that, say, impinge on your discipline. It's much easier to try to keep abreast of your specialization and ignore all the rest. But I'm not sure you can do that.
No, I don't think
that's
possible. One other comment I was going to say is that there is an interesting amount of criticism of evolutionary theory within scientific circles.
Yeah.
It comes out in scientific journals.
Yeah.
Not widely read, and it's difficult to publish a contrary opinion.
However,
there have been several good articles that have come out in the last 4 or 5 years that have criticized the presuppositions of most of the modern evolutionary theory, mm-hmm. such as punctuated equilibrium.
Yes.
And these are being approached from a purely secular standpoint,
yeah.
just simply analyzing the information that's available and how well the data fit the hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And so, even within the scientific community, there are significant and sincere calls for a rethinking of the hypothesis and of what's being put forth, because it does not really match and is not supported by the data.
But of course, those are intended to be mostly in family, in house kinds of discussions and not for the outside. Yeah. 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 Thank you. Well, other comments, questions on this section on creation in general? Obviously, we're going to look at creation of the unseen spirit world, then creation of the material world, and then creation of man. That'll be interesting, those two other subjects. All right. Shall we take a break? Let's hold it to 10 minutes, okay? If we hold it